preach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure.
All right.
And I always get stuck right here.
Now we don't have anything else to say. We've said who we are.
We can say, yeah, but we need to say who we are and are.
And are.
So that's an R and R.
Yes.
The Personal Wealth Coach is also, not coincidentally, an investment advisory firm registered with the United States Securities and Exchange Commission as its primary regulator. And it is located, domiciled, and otherwise generally exists during normal business hours in Salado, Texas. Now, do we exist outside of regular business hours? That's one of the questions, the great eternal questions of
time
itself.
You're going to start the whole program off with existentialism. Whether or not we exist when other people can't get a hold of us. We'll see.
Well, now, if I can't grab something, if I can't get a hold of it, does it actually exist?
Well, technically speaking, you can't really even get a hold of something. At the very minute level, you're not really coming in contact with anything.
But I can get a hold on you.
Yes.
And during the week, a person could come to our place of business. But the funny thing
is... Are you saying we would put them on hold?
Probably.
It could be.
Yeah. And you know, the Personal Wealth Coach, being a limited liability company, an LLC...
Uh-huh.
Have you ever tried to actually locate an LLC and touch it? I mean, I don't think you can do it.
You can. It's just papers. You hold the papers,
the papers
and they have a seal on them. And
the papers proclaim that it exists.
Right.
But, you know, it's a tree or a rock. You know, you can really go out and get a hold of that.
I really enjoy that you've done this. The segue that you have provided is awesome. Because
you mean you're talking about the markets here?
Yeah, this is exactly what we talk about a well-regulated marketplace. Those that listen
Wait a minute,
to us...
That sounds like the Second Amendment.
Right.
A well-regulated militia.
No,
being...
yeah, it's a well-regulated marketplace. Those that listen to us on a regular basis know that we are generally for a smaller government. But there are certain areas that we think are pretty important to be regulated. And one of those areas is this concept of what is a company? What is a corporation? How is it that you know that you own a certain part of it? And these were good questions, and we call that blue sky. How do you own a part?
Is that what you call that?
How do you own a part of the blue sky? And the blue sky laws came from that.
Well, what happens when there's clouds? When you have like an overcast, there isn't no blue sky. I mean, there is one, but you can't see it.
Then you have a question. And meteorologists get this all the time, but if we're talking about the market, we want very correct data. Meteorologists don't have correct data. What is the cloud coverage? What is the percentage of cloud coverage in the blue sky? And the reality of that is technically impossible to come up with unless you are somehow able to view all of the blue sky.
Right. Believe me, I know that. But this is the issue. I think the whole idea is that the blue sky is not really there. Because if you go up there and you try to find it, higher and higher and higher, it just gets black.
Talk about smoke and mirrors here. This is just light refracting from our atmosphere.
And at least half of the time, the sky isn't blue anyway.
Right.
It's black. Well, it's not really black. It's kind of an orange color, but you can't see it.
Yeah, and this comes back. We're talking about blue sky as if it's important. If you own a stock in a company.
If you looked up someday in the middle of the day, and the blue sky, it wasn't cloudy, and the blue sky wasn't there, that would be important.
It might be. And people on the space station do it regularly.
Yes, but they are in a very tiny minority.
Yes, very, very tiny. So this concept of... How do you know what you own? We have an LLC. That's the organizational thing that we are a part of. But what is it? It's an idea. All we have is an idea of an idea. Because all we do is advice, which is just ideas. And then it's incorporated into a bigger idea that we've all agreed means something.
We also make men older.
Right.
Management,
yes.
Management,
yes.
Right.
We people get white hair listening to us
That's
talk
what happened
very
to
quickly.
Me. Right.
Yeah, they just listen to our program for about 5 minutes.
So we provide investment management, and when we're done, I feel older.
Right. I had a conversation earlier this week with someone that said that all money was counterfeit.
All money was counterfeit.
Right.
Now, I don't think that could be correct.
I totally
because the
agree
definition
with you.
Of counterfeit.
It means it doesn't fit.
Right. And money
it's
does
the opposite
and,
of fitting.
And if you go right into the next room, there's a place where you can put a dollar bill
into a
or
machine.
Other money into a thing, and if it doesn't fit, it'll stick it out. So
right.
It's not counterfeit, it's actual fit.
It's actual fit.
Right.
Yes. The reason why this person thought that all money was counterfeit
mm-hmm.
is because it doesn't represent anything but ideas.
Okay.
And I said, so do corporations, so do cities, so is authority of police. So, I mean,
marriage.
All civilization
yeah.
is a concept that we all share, or
right.
at least share most of together.
Right. Right.
And there are different versions of that. So money is a representation of the same thing that our laws are a representation of. It's the same mm-hmm. thing as a representation of what a company is and what we own. Because if you really think about the concept of ownership, this is something the Native Americans didn't get. We've got Native American blood. Between the two of us, you have more.
Where? I don't see any blood.
I have a knife.
I don't want to see
you,
blood
you want
between
to see
us.
Your negative... I, no.
Above all, do not want to see bad blood between us.
So this concept of ownership, real estate ownership, fee simple ownership, the ability to say this is mine, is only a concept. Does that mean that all land that you own is counterfeit?
It all depends on whether it fits.
Yeah, I suppose that's the case. And thinking of money as if it is a chicken doesn't work very well because we left the bartering system a long time ago.
Right.
It is very difficult to buy things with chickens. However, according to
it can be done.
According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Consumer Price Index, chicken and egg prices are at an all-time high.
Right. I was actually going to talk about that today. Why the extremely low inflation year over year of 0.8% that was just reported for December.
And yet electricity, chicken, and egg prices are at all-time highs.
Right.
For the
I
year.
Was talking about why, I was even going to discuss why grocery prices are at an all-time high and
we could
why
just
they are
give
likely
a blanket statement.
To
it's conceptual.
Not
it's all conceptual.
It's the chicken to euro, it's the chicken to euro ratio and probably has something to do with the fact that the Swiss Central Bank unpegged the Swiss franc from the euro.
Right. I thought peg was a name
I thought
that
was
gave
really neat.
To a pig, but Peg the pig was some, but hey, yeah. 30%, it's funny, rise in the value of the franc versus the euro.
Well,
followed immediately by a drop.
Right, but mostly the franc is way the heck up and the euro is way the heck down, relatively speaking.
But we wanted to talk about chickens and electricity first.
Right. Well, you know, I actually have some experience with chickens and electricity.
Yeah, me too. It's shocking.
Well,
you see what I did with it, shocking and the electricity.
When I was a kid, I lived in a place where we raised chickens, and we also had a little electric fence.
Oh, yeah.
And a little...
Learn a lot of
a
lessons
small
in
small line of electric
there.
Fence running along low to keep the chickens out of the hog pen, because chickens going into the hog pen found their life expectancy to shrink
Hogs
suddenly.
Like it. Hogs like it a
the
lot.
Hogs thought it was really
something
cool.
Something to play with.
Yes. But the chickens needed to stay out of the hog pen.
Mm-hmm.
The chickens were the only animals I've ever seen in my life that will repeatedly come back to an electric fence.
They don't need a head.
Right. We used to experiment with that, and right. we finally got
They don't learn very well.
This is a family. Is this a family radio show? Anyway,
I don't know. It hasn't had children yet.
So we performed an experiment one time when we were going to kill a chicken, which was intended for the stew pot. Now you don't do this if you're going to fry the chicken because it makes them really tough. But what we did is we heated up this knife until it was really, 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 like, glowing.
Uh-huh.
And we cut the head off the chicken.
Uh-huh.
Which wasn't our normal procedure.
So it cauterized the wound.
Right, so it didn't bleed. Because we wanted to see how long the chicken would run around with his head cut off. You know, the story, like a chicken running around with his
right.
head cut off.
Sure.
They ran around quite a while if you just snap their neck and yank their heads off. But if you cut them and cauterize them... We were unable to come up with any valid data for how long the chicken would run around. Now, when you say run around, they run around, they fall, they get up, they run some more,
in
they fall,
case,
they get up.
In that case, it would just be starving to death.
We got extremely bored watching the chicken running right. around, and it was also terrifying the other chickens.
Yeah, yeah. There's a case, recorded case, easily look up. I believe it was in the 1920s, where a man knew his mother-in-law really liked chicken necks, so when he removed the head of a chicken, he did it very close to the head. Not a lot of neck got in there.
Right, yeah, right.
The chicken, he just waited for it to fall down, and it never fell down. The bleeding stopped. It continued to live. It lived for a year and a half, and it went on a tour with a freak show and made a lot of money.
So he was feeding it during this time.
Right, and they were actually able to dissect it when it finally did die because it died from choking. It couldn't swallow properly. So it was several years later, though. And the lower portion, the very lowest portion of the brain that kind of sticks down into the neck, was still attached to the neck. And that was evidently enough for the chicken to survive, to eat, to have its heart continue mm-hmm. to beat, all the things that we would say you normally require a brain for, it didn't. And this is, you know, I realize that we've taken a,
do you realize,
some would call it a rabbit trail, we took a chicken trail.
Well, there may be some wisdom in this, because we've noticed that when people who run for office.
Right.
Seem to have some degree of intelligence and sense.
It seems to go away when they run for office.
However, when they arrive en masse in Washington, D.C. and go into the Congress, collectively, they appear to be without heads. Now, I'm wondering if there's some correlation between that and the chicken who can live for an extended period of time without a head. Because they seem to lose sight of what they're there for, no vision.
Right.
They can't smell how badly their statements stink. But as soon as they get back to their local districts, all of a sudden they're brilliant, intelligent people again.
Right. Interesting.
I mean, we probably could get a grant from the National Education Association Foundation or something.
This is valid research to determine why it is that intelligence seems to drop by the average number of people in the room.
I have a hypothesis. In a mob, and I think Congress is to some degree a mob.
I think all degrees a mob. Sometimes two mobs. Most of the
intelligence of a mob. I actually read this somewhere, but I can't give you a cite for it because I can't remember where I read it. The intelligence of a mob is their average intelligence divided by the number of people.
Right.
So if there's 435 people in Congress.
And even if they were genius level, 165 IQ.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're.
You can see what happens.
You divide that by 435, and they have less intelligence collectively than an amoeba.
Right, they're right up there, a slightly higher than a rock.
I don't know. Rocks at least are content to do nothing until something
right.
is forced.
These are active rocks that tend to get in everyone's way.
Maybe an ROC rock.
Rock. Like a large
extinct.
Bird.
Yes.
Yes.
A large. Well, there we're back to the issue of cutting the heads off of birds.
Okay, so back to chickens and prices.
We have a closure.
Right. We're back full loop. Back to chickens. Why is it that when people talk about inflation, I'm going to prep you with the question because I get this too, so I'll prep
mm-hmm,
you with
mm-hmm.
it. Why is it that inflation numbers are reported and fuel prices are up, and the things that we buy at the grocery store are up, and yet inflation is flat or down? Why is it that when the economists talk about inflation, they say it after taking out the things that are used most often by retirees?
Because there was a drought in California.
Aha! So, sorry, people that are retired. There's a drought in California.
I can give you a site on this. It's January 16th, 2015. It is in the Real-Time Economics, the Wall Street Journal. And the title is Why You Won't See Low Inflation in the Dairy Case. Now, not that you would see higher or low. Well, the dairy case includes eggs.
Yeah.
And what the reason is because there was a drought in California. And droughts in California are generally associated with increased grocery prices.
Yep.
But the effects do not occur immediately. And because the drought is pretty much over in California, about a year from now,
prices should come down.
We should see grocery prices beginning to fall. So,
and the same is true with electricity, by the way, not about the drought in California.
I would say a drought in California might cause a rise in electricity prices.
Well, there is a rise in electricity price because of that, but that's not major, the electricity this year, 24, this last year, 2014, was, since the records have been kept, the highest average year prices in electricity on record. This is a fascinating statement.
Of course, you have to have electricity on record at that point.
Right. If you have unrecorded electricity, then too bad. All right. So why is it that with oil prices down, with all this stuff going on, that when people are talking about fuel prices down, how is it that electricity is up?
My personal anecdotal experience is the reverse of that.
That fuel is not down and electricity is not up?
Electricity, we just recontracted to get electricity values, and they have dropped by, since we first started in the position of being able to find our own carriers.
Right, deregulation.
Generators, the carrier is, we only have one carrier.
Right.
The price has dropped by 60%, and it dropped again at the end of last year. So my experience is that the price of electricity has indeed come down. As a matter of fact, the contract we got is good for 6 months, and it is tied to the price of natural gas.
Okay, so ding, 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 give the man a prize. You said in your statement there part of the reason why electricity is high, and that is that these generators
change. Oh, yeah, I got it.
These generators have long-term contracts on fuel.
Mm-hmm.
And the long-term contracts, everybody that I know of, and probably you, as you know, most people have gotten these offers from the electric company. Mm-hmm. We will lock in your price as an average price for the whole year. It's just a limited time offer. You have to respond within a certain period of time, and then they will lock in your price for the whole year. And you can do it at any time, but they have a limited time offer every time you say it.
In other words, what I got was a futures contract.
Yes.
For electricity.
That's what's going on. And every time you do that, your electricity generator buys a contract on fuel.
Every time somebody does that?
Well, they do
it. Just me?
Just you. Yeah, everybody else, they say, no, never mind. No.
Jeff McClure just bought a six-month contract for his minuscule use of electricity in his house. Therefore, we're going to go out and spend
lots of money.
Millions of dollars and buy a contract for fuel.
No, this is why they have the limited time offer, because they get these clumps of people that buy. They say, all right, we have agreed to keep an average bill for 6 months or a year. They lock in at that. The generating company, the electricity generating company, goes out and buys sufficient fuel for that number of people to lock in the price.
Well,
they also buy their own lock-in prices if they think that the price is going to go up. A lot of people have thought that lately.
Actually, ours isn't an average price. It's so many pennies per kilowatt hour, period.
Right, right. Well, that's pennies per kilowatt hour has to do with a different commodity. Enron got into some problems regulating
that. That's our price. We use a certain number of kilowatt hours, and we pay so many, 1-point-something cent, which is amazingly inexpensive.
Right, and that's one part of the reason why electricity is high. Another part, and there's two more parts. Another part is something you have mentioned in the past. We are at maximum rail capacity, or very close, for certain parts of the day, and big chunks of the time. When the rail lines are filled up with very large amounts of oil and gas going from place to place, there's less room for coal.
I just thought they had trains.
They do have trains. It's very they have to be trained to do what they're doing.
I've not seen oil and gas running down there. I've just seen trains.
Oh, they run it down. They just a big hose.
Got
that
it.
It goes into these little containers and stick it on the tracks.
Right.
So there's less room for coal, which means that coal prices, even though there's a lot of coal available, in certain places in the United States, it's hard to get it because there's so much oil and gas on the railway, and we haven't expanded that capacity.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another thing. And the last piece is that there are new regulations coming online for coal plants to clean them up. The older coal plants are being brought up to a newer standard, and that's expensive. So you put these three things together, there's a lot of people complaining about it, and the EPA is
Actually, the differential in electric prices across the country is quite substantial.
Yes, hugely different from different places.
This is one of those things where our system in Texas has been giving much such praise because we've had such a booming economy, which, by the way, may not be so booming this coming year.
Yeah.
But
our electric grid is separate from the rest of the country.
There's three major grids,
and Texas is one of them.
And we are benefiting from the fact that almost all the electricity, not all of it, but almost all of it is generated by, let me back up. The majority of it is generated by natural gas. We also have a lot of wind power. And
we're full of wind here.
We have a lot of cheap coal that we burn. And factually, we in Texas have really got cheap electricity. People are saying they're moving businesses to Texas because of our free enterprise, low tax. Well, there's another thing. It's really, really cheap energy.
Cheap energy, cheap labor, highly educated.
You got it.
And innovative.
Boy, there's a whole world there. one of the reasons when CEOs are surveyed on certain companies, labor-intensive companies, why they want to move to Texas, one of the reasons is because there's a lot of people who will work for minimum or below wage.
Right.
Who happen to speak Spanish as their first language, which is something that Texans strongly object to while they're proud of the fact that a lot of companies are moving here.
that is true.
Anyway, we got to play some commercials, and you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. I don't think we've even given our telephone numbers yet.
Why would we do that?
I don't know. I mean, they're still the same. You know, we give them out every week.
Nobody ever gives them back.
But they're always here. We always have an unlimited number of telephone numbers. No matter how many times we give them out.
It's always the same one, though.
I got to work on this. 773-1400 if you're in East Bell County is the number to call.
Otherwise, 1-866-597-1400.
And we'll be back on the other side of these very important words from Town Square's and KTEM's sponsors. And we're back, third tries a charm, with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And if today is January 17th, Saturday, the year of our Lord 2015, the day when, is it Marty McFly? Was that his name?
It's not the day, it's the year.
The year when Marty McFly arrives from the past. It's October, I think, isn't it, when he's supposed to arrive?
I believe so.
So we'll be looking for Marty McFly, and we've got some real serious technological advances to make between now and October.
Well, I mean, I think we mentioned this last week. Bill Gates unveiled his machine that turns waste into electricity and water.
That's a good start.
So we just need to get it portable enough to put it on a vehicle.
Cars.
And in this particular case, his machine ran on a different kind of waste than what they were talking about in Back to the Future 2. His machine runs on human poo, where our machines supposedly are to run on trash.
So, yeah, and that was because the price of oil was so outrageously high that no one could afford it.
Well, it was almost right.
Anyway, the telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400. I have one more thing to hit statistically, just since last hour
since the last hour. Well,
statistically speaking, we've only covered a few statistics this hour.
That's correct, yes.
The numbers just came out on the low-income school population in public schools in the United States.
And the numbers are 1.
No, that's a different number.
0.
Those are other numbers.
Oh, okay.
51% of the student population in public school is low-income.
That makes them a majority.
The majority of students
are below average.
Wait a minute.
Except in one place in the United States.
Yes, so this can be very confusing when people look at these numbers and they say, wait a minute, half of the kids are low income? Are people cheating on, you know, because this is for lunch assistance, food assistance programs all over the country. Are people cheating on this? How can more than half of the people are low income? That doesn't make sense. Well, it does. Who has babies? Who has more babies?
Women.
Women have babies.
Yes.
And a woman in this country gives birth to a baby about every 20 seconds.
We need to find that woman, give her an award.
Stop that lady.
No.
Somebody let her give her a break.
She's doing a great job.
You're right. So when it comes back to it, we have more kids being born to low-income people than being born to high-income people.
Mm.
That's the simpleness. Now, what does that say for the quality of education? Because the southern states have a bigger problem than the northern states. And the states that are right around the border have a pretty high problem. That isn't the worst place, though, by the way. Mississippi has over 70% of its school-age population is in need of assistance.
Because it is so darned hard to spell the state's name.
Well, I think I learned how to spell Mississippi very early. Most kids do because it's so fun to spell.
Yeah, but that stuff at the end you're not even supposed to say.
That it's fun to spell?
No, M-I-S-S-I-S-S.
I-P-P.
No, we don't. We're not supposed to say that in school.
Yeah, so everyone generally learns to spell that state quickly, but they also generally learn to leave the state if they want to make money, and that seems to be the issue. Their infrastructure, their tax system, there's a whole bunch of stuff wrong at Mississippi, but it's coming out in the schools when we look around and we see numbers like that. First off, the thing that I need to say is that means that we need to increase funding for schools. People go, wait a minute, are you talking communism here? Well, sort of. If we don't increase the quality of education, it means that the next generation, if they just keep to the status quo, are going to be low earners. We don't want that.
You mean to say it's not already going on?
Well, I am saying that. That's one of the things that is a problem going into this particular part of our history, is that the high-income people are making more money and the low-income people are making less money and the middle class seems to be stagnant. If we don't allow the skills and training to go to the people that are having kids, to their kids, then our country is going to go downhill. That means that we need to increase the quality of our schools. It means that even though we look around and go, you know, I'm about to have a child in my family, but all the way up to this point in my life, I have been paying property taxes in multiple counties for other people's kids to go to school. I think it's probably a good idea that I continue to pay for other people's kids to go to school so that
I tend to think that's good too.
When we go to hire people, they actually know what to do when we hire them.
Well, that's a problem, and which can bring us to another report that came out. There was, let's see if I can find it here now. There was a report that there's actually a solid test that says college graduates lack skills for white-collar jobs.
Well, they just probably need to get some more bleach in their laundromat.
The issue is that 40% of students, according to this test that was this big survey that was done, they said 4 in 10 U.S. college students graduate without the complex reasoning skills to manage white collar work. That was a test that was administered to 32,000 students around the country, freshmen and seniors, and they determine that indeed 4 years of college does improve
their
reasoning
the
skills.
Oh, that's nice. At least it's not being total waste.
But upon graduation with a bachelor's degree, 40% of the students are unable to identify an illogical argument as being illogical. I started to use the term they used in there, but it's a bit, I'm not sure a lot of people would understand that. And they also will accept false premise and do not are basically unable to challenge a false assumption. They don't have this. In other words, they graduate from...
Well, we train that into them. We train that into them. We train it into the population.
Right.
I talked about this a separate study, but it has a lot to do with this last week. And that is when the neuroscientists took a group of people and split them by political party and had them do this learning and test. they found that people are quite willing to suspend their rational minds when it comes to something that they believe passionately in. In this case, it was political stuff.
But in this particular case, they don't even need to believe passionately.
Right.
They just don't have the skills. It's not a matter of suspending their normally rational thought process.
Uh-huh.
They don't have one to begin with.
Well, that's the thing that we're training. Every time that someone, an adult or a teacher, suspends their rational mind, assuming that they know how to use it at all, for a passion, it trains the next generation that they don't need it as much.
And this is what and employers give an even lower score. They are saying 90% of college graduates do not have the reasoning, research, and analytical skills necessary to function in a managerial position.
I believe that to be completely the case. I believe that to be true. Most college graduates that I've met need a lot of further training before they're able to, and just look at the Army.
There's a Richard Arum, A-R-U-M, who wrote a book called Academically Adrift and things like that. He wrote several books on the subject. But what he said was employers are saying, I don't care about all the knowledge you learned, because it's going to be out of date 2 minutes after you graduate. I care about whether you can continue to learn over the time and solve complex problems. And, no, that was Deborah Humphreys who was recorded to say this in the Wall Street Journal. The point I want to make here is that
it sounds like every sergeant that's ever spoken to any second lieutenant.
Right.
It's
except the second lieutenants, thing. In many cases, I think, had the skills to begin to learn.
Right, begin to learn.
But if you look at the number of second lieutenants versus first lieutenants versus captains, you find, and by the time you get to major, you've lost a tremendous number of people.
At that point, you stop winnowing out people for lack of managerial skills, and you start winnowing them out for lack of political skills.
Yeah, well, so the point is that there is, you talked about the education system, and one of the things that we in the Personal Wealth Coach work with and are very conscious of is something called, it's actually called neo-institutional economics. It's easier to just say institutional economics. Douglas North was one of the founders of that science.
Yeah, not to be confused with institutional economics, because that's completely different. It's new institutional.
Or neo.
Right, or neo.
Yes. Which has something to do with the matrix.
Correct.
But he got the you want to look at his stuff, he got the Nobel Prize in 1993. But he basically said that institutions, a society, a socioeconomic system like the United States, is a socioeconomic system, and the system is composed of institutions, and the system is no more or less strong than the institutions within it. And if you try, and it's necessary to allow institutions to fail, and if necessary, to cause their failure to keep the system strong. It's called creative destruction. It was a term coined by a guy named Schlumpter a long time ago. But there are several institutions in the United States that are threatening the existence of our system. One of them is the medical institution, which is in an upheaval right now as it is being corrected, and a lot of people don't like it.
And in some cases, overcorrected, but it's still there's an effort being made.
At least we're stirring it up, and because it could bankrupt the entire nation and easily could do that. The other one, the big one, that we're really not dealing with is the educational system.
There are a few others as well.
But the biggest single threat right now is the educational system. We have a 19th century designed public education system that spills over into the higher education system and continues to charge along with its 19th century design. We have a system that is designed to educate agriculturally based students.
Right. This is why we have summer
and
breaks.
Bring them into an industrial society. But the problem with that is we now have a post-industrial society.
Yep.
And as a result,
we industrialize posts.
We frankly, and this is one of the rare things where Lynn Woolley and I agree completely, our school systems are socialist monopolies that are very dangerous.
I agree. And that statement that I made just a minute ago about over the vast majority in Texas. It's 60% of the students in Texas, but over 50% of the students in the country are in the low income area. They are qualified for food assistance. And that's a statement about a lot of things. It's a statement about who's having babies. It's a statement about what we're willing to spend on schools. Because if you start looking at average scores for these standardized tests, the number of failures is huge. And it's going up, not down. Our quality is suffering. And part of that is due to the home. When students go home to something, and, you know, I could go on and on and on about this. Another example, I said there were several other examples, but we can come back to education. There's not enough time in the program for education. Nowhere near.
There is more to that
even
than
the concept. But another symptom of the fact that our institutions move very, very, very slowly is there's a lot of debate right now over net neutrality. We spoke about that a little bit last week, over how the FCC is governing municipalities, and it's going to go to the court on whether or not the municipalities in certain states are allowed to determine which trunk of which line goes and which rings go around where for broadband purposes. And there's a problem here. So this is national attention. You know, Google and Facebook and a lot of the other major online institutions posted on their pages once several years ago about problems with a new act that was coming out to regulate the internet. We need to put an act in place. Those were not the correct ones. Those were SOPA and PIPA. I just like those words. SOPA, PIPA. Anyway.
M-I-S-S-I-S-S.
Yes. The act that is being used to regulate the internet right now is the Telecom Act of 1996. So the act that's being used to regulate the internet was made before there was an internet, before there was something to regulate. So they're trying to regulate the internet the way they regulate cable companies and the way they regulate telephone companies. That doesn't work. And what's more, just so that you can see how quickly we are used to moving here, the Telecom Act of 96 had to be updated. This was a new thing. It was a great change in our society in 1996 when we upgraded to this new and better way of regulating things so that we could be up with the norm of the present and modern day, because it was...
There was a lot of cable companies out there.
Right. We were replacing the Communications Act of 1934.
Which comes back to Douglas North's right. Geoeconomics.
Exactly.
Where in a crisis where you have multiple institutional collapses going on simultaneously, which, by the way, is how we fix things in the West,
yeah,
in our system.
We got education falling apart and communications, yeah, falling apart. And
when we do this, is when we come up with new tools for stabilizing economic transactions, and we generally allow the old tools to remain in place, even though we're chipping away at high carbon steel with flint axes,
right?
Until we get a major crisis.
Well,
and
it would
and
be
I,
nice if we
I
could
prefer
circumvent
not,
it.
It'd be nice, but
we have Congress, and that's
the opposite of progress,
right? So Congress will not progress here. We're not going to have a good law when it comes to the internet for quite some time. We're not going to have
so
a
no
change.
Law is better than a bad law.
Correct. We're not going to have a change to the education system for the next probably 10 years, although I find that to be absolutely ludicrous. I mean, if you take any efficiency expert, any intelligence expert, you take all the neuroscience that we have today and apply it to the schools, and we find it is a broken system.
And I do think it will be about 10 years if we follow history, because the current system is a modified 19th century system.
Uh-huh.
And it was put in place in the 1920s because of they didn't change it radically, but they put it in place in the 1920s because mechanical innovations, tractors, trucks, and so on, we're changing the farm to make it far more efficient,
You could actually send your kids to school for a while.
Well, the other side of it is that we just had a tremendous number of people who had been working in agriculture who found out that agriculture didn't need them anymore, and they needed to move into things where they turned wrenches, basically. In other words, they need to move into heavy manufacture.
Yeah, they took a war.
And so now we have gotten rid of heavy manufacture, or it's going away.
Right.
It's being replaced by machines in exactly the same way. So now we need to move people into being, for lack of a better term, computer capable.
Yeah. Creating the things that the machines do.
And that's one of the things, by the way, that this study showed, is that 40% of college graduates, you sit them down in front of a computer with a keyboard, and they're unable to construct a logical set of words on a page. In other words, they can write a sentence, but they can't write, for example, a letter from one person to, you know, if you write a letter to a business person or somebody else explaining what we're doing or why this is, and they were incapable of doing it, which pretty much resonates with my experience. Only like other employers, I would tend to say it's closer to 90% are incapable of doing that. And a big piece of it is, very frankly, the higher education system and the lower education system have dumbed down the process pretty dramatically. And I'm going to have to lay at least part of that at the feet of George W. Bush and his No Child Left Behind, because he shifted the funding from the upper level education to the lower level education. No Child Left Behind means aim the money
at the low
people who need to spend several years learning how to tie their shoes, which is very important. Don't misunderstand.
It is important. Very important.
But if you don't raise the budget and you increase the emphasis on, and it's a logical thing, by the way, because we have many, many, many special education students. And if those special education students can be made capable of functioning in a halfway house or
a group
setting, it saves the government a lot of money. Whereas if you aim it towards the upper end of the scale, it makes society a lot of money. And the issue is that we emotionally respond positively to No Child Left Behind. But the issue here is you can't have both at the same budgetary level.
Correct.
Because both of them require a lot more, both the upper end of the education and the lower end. In other words, the more academically capable children require much more money to educate than the middle of the group, than the middle.
Right.
And the very low academically capable children require a lot of money to educate. And they're even more expensive because it requires almost a one-on-one ratio with
remedial
teachers.
Right.
So the issue is, first, overhaul the system. Secondly, give it the money it needs to get the job done once you've overhauled it. But we have this problem in our country in that education is almost exclusively controlled very locally by election.
Right.
And people tend to elect people who promise to take it back to what was when they were children.
Right.
And that won't function in today's world.
What I would really like to see here is probably not going to happen, is something similar to the Telecom Act of 1996, which put in what we've used to deregulate the communication systems that are out there. We need to deregulate schools, take the tax money that is being paid by parents or the amount of money that would go to a child and give them a voucher for it. Put the competition into the education process.
We'd love to do that, except for the fact we'd take a constitutional amendment. I think the chances of getting one of those, because...
Well, we'd have to do it on the state level.
Yeah.
It would take
it's already been done. You realize it's already, to a large extent, done in some... Connecticut. I realize no Republican likes Connecticut. It is one of the most solidly arch-liberal...
Right, but they are extremely high earners.
Mm-hmm. And they've pumped some serious money into their education system, and as a result, the quality of education has gone up dramatically.
Right, but that's the public school system.
Mm-hmm.
And that's possible. But we also have the ability right now. We know that there are good schools and bad schools. And all this talk about compensating teachers based on merit is very difficult, because you really have to determine the merit And that we do based on standardized tests.
If we have a
system where there's direct competition between schools, direct in a way that says we have quality and they don't.
And not a competition that is run by a government that's giving tests and requiring evaluations.
But actually by outcome.
Right.
The parents are going to know where the good schools are.
Salado schools, for example, get more people trying to move their students from out of district into Salado than they can handle every year.
And that's with very similar price structures because they're Robin Hooded and have to send money elsewhere. So the price structure in Killeen and the price structure in Salado is very similar.
But there's a higher quality in Salado.
But there's a higher quality in Salado. And that doesn't say that that we're talking about a bad system in Killeen. This is the issue. When it gets to bad versus good,
well, there are some bad ones in Killeen.
Right. We don't have the tools to measure the difference because they're being run by governments.
Let the marketplace.
Absolutely.
But again, I don't think that
it's not going to happen.
No, I think, and the funny thing is, this is what's weird. The more conservative red state a place gets, the more socialist their school systems get.
Yeah.
Now, I know that sounds really, really crazy, but for instance, in Connecticut, if you don't like the school system
you can transfer your child.
Can easily go to a different school system. If they have the capacity, you can move it in there. The more conservative states just simply don't allow that.
Right.
And it is really a strange phenomenon that more conservative voters prefer more socialist school systems.
And I'm going to say this at the risk of shocking all of our listeners.
Uh-oh. Okay, we're back to the cost of electricity.
Well, yeah, shocking, isn't it? I believe that the education system reform takes priority over income tax reform.
I agree with you. But,
and that is very shocking because I think income tax reform is one of the greatest detriments to our economy. Without income tax, the income tax that we have right now is one of the greatest detriments to our economy, period, except that our school system is going to be worse.
The problem is, again, it can't be controlled at the federal level.
No, it's got to be state level. We already control
it's
it
not
at
even
state
at
level
the state level.
And the local level.
It has to be local, and that is one of the issues that we face. It is.
Well, the voucher system has to be a state level thing. Local level has to be told to conform to that, which means that new schools would have to open up on a private basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the current schools would have to go private.
We're almost out of time. But there's an argument against that, too, because the worst college educations right now, by and large, are coming out of private schools, where people are assembling a huge quantity of debt.
Yeah.
And they're coming out with a degree, and they are unable to find a job because they haven't learned the skills necessary
right
to work.
There's a specific group of private colleges and private universities that fall in that category. And then you have the private universities that are the best.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the top-level education, they may get a little bit of public funding, but they're not public schools.
Sure, but what I'm saying is, with the availability of private education comes the issue of how do you know they just won't give cheap but expensive private education?
Correct.
There's room for a lot of debate here.
That's where the market gets to determine it. If you can look around and say this isn't working now,
but the
when
market,
you've got student loans that are governed by anybody gets to do whatever they want. We're almost out of time. We can continue this next hour. If you'd like to reach us off the air, you can reach us locally at 947-1111. You can reach us at 800-914-7526, 800-914-PLAN. Both of those are voicemail right now. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, or email us at Jeff@tpwc.com or Jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.